From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
It turns out that everything about the planned transfer of sovereignty in Iraq on June 30th has been a deception. It's not a transfer of sovereignty. It's not a signpost on the road to a democratic Iraq. And it turns out even the date was wrong.
In a surprise move, the U.S. holds a secret ceremony in Baghdad, marking the so-called handover of power to the new unelected government of Iraq. 2 days before the June 30th deadline. We'll be broadcasting from Iraq, from Jordan, and we're here in Kansas City. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a surprise move, the U.S. held a secret ceremony in Baghdad earlier today to mark the so-called handover of power to the new unelected government of Iraq. The handover was scheduled to take place on Wednesday, June 30th, but the U.S. moved up the date with hopes that it would preempt further attacks by members of the Iraqi resistance to coincide with the handover. The ceremony was attended by a handful of Iraqi and coalition officials, including the head of the Coalition Prohibition Authority, Paul Bremer, and Iyad Alawi, who is selected to be Iraq's prime minister. Alawi is a former Baathist who has ties to the CIA and Saudi intelligence. Iraq's newly selected president, Ghazi Yawar, was also present. Over the past week, scores of Iraqis have died in attacks that were apparently staged to disrupt the handover of power. President Bush was in Turkey at the NATO summit while Bremer presided over the ceremony in Iraq. Bremer left the country on a U.S. Air Force C-130 at about 12:30 p.m. Baghdad time, shortly after the ceremony ended. Technically, the handover of power ends the 14-month occupation of Iraq, but many questions remain as to how much power the U.S. has actually handed over. The U.S. keeps at least 130,000 troops on the ground. U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte will head up the largest embassy in the world. The new government will be barred from amending the interim constitution that was drawn up by the U.S. and U.S.-appointed governing council. The U.S. has put in place numerous laws to protect U.S. forces and contractors. On Saturday, Bremer signed an edict that gave U.S. soldiers and military contractors immunity from Iraqi laws even after the handover of power. The Washington Post reports Paul Bremer has also issued a series of other edicts that could affect how Iraq will be governed for years. He has appointed at least 24 Iraqis to government jobs with 5-year terms, including Iraq's new national security advisor and national intelligence chief. This means the U.S. will have high-placed allies in government, regardless of who wins the upcoming Iraqi elections. Bremer has also formed a 7-member election commission that will have the power to disqualify political parties and candidates. Meanwhile, it's been widely reported Alawi is considering imposing martial law or issuing special emergency laws. Alawi said during the ceremony, quote, "The security situation of our country now lies in our hands. We're going to announce the new measures today and tomorrow," he said. Over the weekend, Alawi also announced the U.S. would soon hand over Saddam Hussein to the new Iraqi government. The transfer of power came after a weekend that saw dozens of Iraqis die as members of the resistance launched attacks across the country. In Hilla, a double car bombing killed up to 40 people. In Bakuba, gunmen attack the offices of Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's party, the Iraq National Accord, the offices of one of the country's biggest Shiite parties, the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, also came under attack. At a checkpoint north of Baghdad, six Iraqi National Guard soldiers were killed by anti-tank rockets. Two Iraqi children died in a mortar attack near the Sheraton Hotel in Baghdad. A U.S. soldier died in Baghdad in a rocket attack on the coalition's base. Meanwhile, U.S. forces bombed Fallujah again, killing up to 25 people in an attempt to kill supporters of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Meanwhile, three Turkish men, one U.S. soldier, and one Pakistani man have been taken hostage by separate resistance groups who threaten to behead the men if demands are not met. The U.S. soldier has been identified as Wasif Ali Hassoun, a Marine corporal of Lebanese descent. The Pakistani man worked for Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root. We'll have more from Iraq in just a few minutes. In Israel, Hamas has carried out today what's being reported as its first ever fatal rocket attack on Israeli soil. The attack killed two Israelis in the southern town of Sderot, including a three-year-old boy on his way to nursery school. Numerous attacks were staged by both Israeli and Palestinian groups over the weekend. In Nablus, 30,000 Palestinians took to the streets on Sunday for the funeral of seven Palestinian militants who had been killed by Israeli forces. The dead included Nayef Abu Sharekh, the head of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the West Bank, and two other senior commanders. Meanwhile, in Gaza, six Israeli soldiers were wounded after members of Hamas set off a bomb underneath an army post in the southern Gaza Strip. Soon after, Israeli forces shot dead two Palestinians, including a 13-year-old boy, in the town of Khan Yunis. And in the Gaza town of Rafah, a delegation from the British charity Christian Aid reported they were shot at by Israeli forces last week as they visited the town on a fact-finding mission. UN Chief Nuclear Weapons Expert Mohammed El-Baradei called on Israel to eliminate its nuclear weapons. According to the BBC, he said everyone knew Israel has nuclear capability, although they refused to admit it. El-Baradei is scheduled to visit Israel next month to discuss making the Middle East a nuclear-free zone. Tens of thousands of people protested President Bush in Turkey yesterday during a NATO summit. The overwhelming majority of the Turkish public opposed the invasion of Iraq. The Turkish government dramatically increased security for Bush's visit. F-16 warplanes patrolled and a no-fly zone was enforced above Istanbul. Hours before Bush's arrival on Saturday, Turkish police fired tear gas at stone-throwing demonstrators in downtown Ankara. Meanwhile, in Ireland, up to 10,000 anti-Bush protesters greeted President Bush, who stopped in the country to hold a news conference with Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern and European Union President Romano Prodi. The protesters delayed the start of the press conference for half an hour, chanting anti-Bush and anti-war slogans. In Haiti, ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's former Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune has been arrested. The new U.S.-backed government charges Neptune is connected with several killings that occurred around the time of the coup that ousted Aristide. Neptune recently took to the Haitian airwaves and called on Aristide's supporters to prepare for a future struggle. The city of New York has announced it will close off at least two dozen city blocks when the Republican National Convention is in session, and that protesters will be restricted to a small area away outside one corner of Madison Square Garden. The head of the New York Civil Liberties Union, Donna Lieberman, responded to the city's attempt to limit where protests could be held by saying, quote, "The mayor does not get to rewrite the First Amendment just because the RNC is coming to town." Meanwhile, New York City has yet to grant any permits to any protest groups. In Milwaukee, delegates at the Green Party political convention have chosen California lawyer David Cobb to be the party's nominee over independent candidate Ralph Nader, who was the Green nominee in 2000 and 1996. If Ralph Nader had won the nomination, he would have gained access to ballots in 22 states. In news from Hollywood, Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 9/11, took in an estimated $22 million at the box office, becoming the most popular film in the country this week and one of the most successful documentaries in film history. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting live from Kansas City, and we are going to Iraq as well as to Jordan. And the latest in the surprise move, the U.S. holding a secret ceremony in Baghdad early this morning to mark the so-called handover of power to the new unelected government of Iraq. The handover scheduled to take place on Wednesday, June 30th, but the U.S. moving up the date. Here is what the Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi, the unelected Prime Minister of Iraq, had to say in Baghdad earlier today.
Also, we salute the forces and peoples that stood by us, like Jordan, Syria, Turkey, and others, as our people was living under the tyranny of Saddam. And also, I have to salute the coalition countries, especially United States, Britain, Italy, Sweden, Japan, South Korea, and all the other coalition countries that helped us liberate Iraq from Saddam and his gang. And we extend the hand of peace to all of them. Dear free people, our dear Iraq is now at a setback, but it is a very temporary setback, and we will rise up after that with the like mountains standing up very firm, and we will protect all the people regardless of religion, color, or any other consideration. So this, every Iraqi will have the right to their unified, united Iraq, where brotherhood and justice prevail.
Iyad Alawi speaking in Baghdad just a little while ago today. We turn now to Patrick Coburn, a reporter for the Independent newspaper. He is in Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Patrick.
Hello.
Can you talk about this surprise move, this ceremony that has taken place 2 days before the expected so-called handover of power, and what Iyad Alawi had to say?
Well, it caught us by surprise, I guess. But obviously, they thought that if it was held on Wednesday, if the handover of power took place on Wednesday, then there would be car bombs in Baghdad, that nobody would pay much attention to what was happening. So they got it in early. I mean, I was walking around Baghdad this morning, and suddenly there is a mood of apprehension here. There's very little traffic on the streets. Normally it's very, very crowded here, enormous traffic jams. Quite a lot of people have gone to Jordan or gone to Syria this week to avoid the violence. So there is a sense that something bad is going to happen here, and in the past, when people have believed that, it usually has happened.
Hmm. Can you talk about what exactly happened as you understand it? How did you learn? How did others in Baghdad learn what was taking place at, what was it, 2:26 Baghdad time in the morning? And then tell us who Iyad Alawi is, the new unelected prime minister of Iraq.
Well, I think the first news really came out of Istanbul from Hossein Zebari, the Iraqi foreign minister, who's normally fairly fairly voluble. Iyad Alawi, he was in the opposition a long time. I mean, he's rather a peculiar political personality. He comes from a Shiite family here. Reasonably well off. He was a Ba'ath Party militant in the 1960s. Accounts differ on exactly what he did. Some say that he was fairly violent at that time, but he was then sent to, he's trained as a doctor, and was then sent to England, where he became head of the Iraqi Students' Union for Europe. Now, it's widely believed that at that point he was working for the Mukhabarat, the Iraqi intelligence, but he broke with Saddam in the mid-70s. He then was attacked and with an axe and knife when he was asleep in bed in his house in London and was quite badly wounded. Went into business. He sort of became prominent again during and after the Gulf War. Now, his movement, the Iraqi National Accord, is fairly notorious for first having been funded by MI6, British intelligence, and subsequently by the CIA. Alawi defends himself by saying, yeah, I took money from not just them, but 13 other intelligence agencies. In the 90s, he backed a coup against Saddam Hussein, based in, which went disastrously wrong. A lot of people were killed. And he really didn't play much role in the war last year. He was not very prominent then, or over the past year. So he seemed almost to be fading out of politics. He wasn't even in Iraq much. But this had the advantage for him that he didn't make too many friends. He didn't make many enemies either. So when it came to them selecting a new prime minister, so somebody who was doing the choosing told me that his name, Alawi's name, emerged because he was the person who had the least enemies. The Kurds, the Shiites, the Sunni Muslims, none of them really disapproved of him in the way they disapproved of other candidates.
You write in your latest piece, Patrick Coburn, in The Independent, you refer to Iyad Alawi as a CIA stooge.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
You refer to Iyad Alawi as a CIA stooge.
Well, I think I mentioned that the Iraqis see him like that. And others are hopeful that whoever he was paid for in the past, that he can, that some form of Iraqi government will develop now, that however bad it is, it won't be as bad as the occupation. Now, they may be disappointed, but Alawi does have some advantages in that the occupation really is very, very unpopular here now. It's quite astonishingly how few Iraqis have a good word to say for Paul Bremer or Coalition Provisional Authority. So perhaps this will work in Alawi's favor. But at the same time, he's very reliant on American troops. There are more police in the streets today. At the end of the day, he's reliant on 138,000 troops. And so he's going to walk a very fine line between saying he's going to end the violence, he's going to end the occupation, but at the same time, he's very dependent on the occupation or the occupying troops for any influence he has in Iraq.
We have to break. We're going to come back to this discussion. We're speaking with Patrick Coburn of The Independent. He is in Baghdad right now with the surprise so-called handover of power 2 days early. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting live from Kansas City, where we're working with community radio station KKFI. We are talking about the secret handover of power that took place 2 days early, or I should say the secret ceremony. The handover is now public, if you can call it that. Small ceremony that took place in Baghdad about 2:26 Baghdad time in the morning. Paul Bremer has now left Iraq. And we are looking at a piece in the Washington Post by Rajiv Chandrasekaran and Walter Pincus. It says, U.S. Administrator L. Paul Bremer has issued a raft of edicts revising Iraq's legal code and has appointed at least 24 Iraqis to government jobs with multi-year terms in an attempt to promote his concepts of government long after the planned handover of political authority on Wednesday. Some of the orders signed by Bremer, which will remain in effect unless overturned by Iraq's interim government, restrict the power of the interim government and impose U.S.-crafted rules for the country's democratic transition. Among the most controversial orders is the enactment of an elections law that gives a 7-member commission the power to disqualify political parties and any of the candidates they support. We are joined on the line right now by Patrick Coburn in Baghdad. Also, Rahul Mahajan joins us. Rahul Mahajan, the author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. He writes a blog called empirenotes.org. The handover took place 2:26 Eastern Standard Time. It took place at 10:26 in the morning Baghdad time. Patrick Coburn, can you talk about these edicts, what Paul Bremer has left as John Negroponte, the new U.S. ambassador to Iraq, moves in?
Bremer's 14 months in power here was really uniformly disastrous. It's still a mystery, I think, to many people here, Iraqis and even officials on the coalition provisional authority that Bremer headed, as to how he managed to take so many disastrous decisions. But Saddam should not have been a hard act to follow. But dissolving the army, the security forces, last year, the attempt to really monopolize all power within the CPA, Coalition Provisional Authority, and then this year to pick a fight in Fallujah with the Sunni Muslims, and it, with Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite Muslim cleric. Really, this led to the vast majority of Iraqis deciding that they wanted the occupation to end. The month by month, you talk to Iraqis, the bitterness against the occupation and against Bremer personally has been growing. So, really, Bremer's record is very mixed, and Iraqis regard it with very negatively.
I want to bring Rahul Mahajan into this conversation, author of Full Spectrum Dominance. Your response to this surprise ceremony taking place 2 days early and what this all means, including these edicts, extremely significant. Paul Bremer has ordered that the National Security Advisor and the National Intelligence Chief chosen by the interim prime minister he selected, Iyad Alawi, be given five-year terms, which will impose Alawi's choices on the elected government that is to take over next year. He's also appointed Iraqis, this is Paul Bremer, handpicked by his aides to many of the influential positions in the interim government, installed inspectors general for five-year terms in every ministry, has formed and filled commissions to regulate communications, public broadcasting, securities markets. Can you comment on all of this?
Yes, well, in terms of the early transfer, it is obviously a prudent measure, and there's nothing to complain about it. It's just that it's symbolic of the tremendous failure of the occupation. This man has spent 14 months as the American proconsul of Iraq, has totally, completely, you know, refashioned the country in his own image, and now has to depart in ignominious shame with his tail between his legs secretly because of the total collapse of even any shred of legitimacy of his government or his policy. So I think this move up of the transfer is very symbolic in that way. And of course, the transfer is not a real transfer. As you pointed out, Bremer took a whole series of last-minute decisions that make it very clear that that in fact he doesn't trust even this puppet government they're putting in to be tightly enough controlled by the United States. In particular, the creation of an election commission that has the power to dismiss other political parties. He promulgated an edict that no party associated with what he calls an illegal militia can run anybody for office, and this is very clearly directed at Muqtada al-Sadr, and it's basically a card to keep close to the vest to be ready to play if Muqtada al-Sadr doesn't show that he's willing to essentially go along with the United States. And it looks like the United States is changing things, but not very much. They tried a model in which they were trying to reinvent 19th century colonialism. That's what the 14 months of the coalition provisional authority was. Now it looks like they're trying to reinvent a sort of 1960s style Latin American corrupt military dictatorship propped up by the United States. And in particular, one of the areas of corruption is in the use of oil revenues. In fact, the British charity Christian Aid just said there's at least $2 billion of Iraq's oil revenues from the last year that are unaccounted for by the CPA accounting.
We're speaking to Rahul Mahajan, Full Spectrum Dominance, responding to the latest news of the early handover. Ali Abu Nima joins us on the line right now from Amman, Jordan. Your latest response, your response to this, Ali.
Well, the news comes on a day when attention in Jordan is facing towards the West to events in Palestine with the massive upsurge in Israeli violence in the past couple of days. So the news came as somewhat of a surprise, but I think that, as the previous commentator said, the handover is maybe trumpeted in the United States as a big deal, but not many people I've talked to here in Amman are particularly impressed by it. And what has surprised me is the vehemence of feeling about Iyad Alawi, that how could anyone who was openly working with the CIA and British intelligence since the 1970s ever be a legitimate leader for Iraq. So I think there's very, very little support, at least here in Jordan, among the public, at least people I've talked to, for the handover, and not many people see it really as a step towards restoring Iraq to sovereignty and independence. And of course, support from Iraq's neighbors is crucial, but at least as far as the public are concerned here in Jordan, that support is not particularly forthcoming right now.
Ali Abu Nima, what about these edicts that Paul Bremer has issued just before leaving the country, putting in place people like a national security advisor, intelligence chief, that were chosen by his handpicked prime minister, who will remain beyond any kind of election, saying that they will serve five-year terms?
Well, people are, people are aware of these kinds of details in a way, because they are being widely covered, and I've seen detailed coverage of this issue on some of the satellite channels. But I think people are really looking at the big picture. They just don't believe that this handover represents any real change. So I don't think people even need to see the edicts or any of that in order to have their skepticism bolstered. The general view is that Iraq remains a country under occupation. I saw a report in the Washington Post this morning which talks about U.S. soldiers preparing to leave as the occupation ends. I mean, as far as I know, it's fiction. The U.S. has announced it plans to increase, or may increase by 25,000, the number of troops, and there are 160,000 there now. And no one is talking about reducing the number of troops in Iraq. So people here see Iraq as being under occupation. They see the handover as being purely cosmetic. They see the Iraqi government as being people use the term here. A lot of people I've talked to use the term collaborators. That's the terminology people are using. So they don't. In a way, the issue of the edict doesn't add very much to people's perception, although I think it's very important that these things be known, because it shows the extent to which the United States is trying to shape and influence what happens in Iraq for many years, if not decades, to come.
We're talking to Ali Abu Nima in Amman, Jordan. He is the founder of ElectronicIntifada.net and ElectronicIraq.net. Patrick Coburn, if you're still on the line with us, in addition to this latest news of the secret ceremony earlier today, the reports of the bombing of Fallujah, once again, killing up to 25 people in an attempt to kill supporters of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. What is the latest on that?
Well, the bombing of Fallujah now has become so regular, and with, at the same time, everything being attributed to Zarqawi as the one figure who seems to be behind the uprisings in the cities all around Baghdad. Overall, I don't think, I mean, what's striking is that 14 months after the invasion, that the U.S. is still using aircraft to hit buildings in a not very big city like Fallujah, which is only 30 miles from Baghdad. It shows, one, the lack of intelligence, but also just the fact that they don't, the whole swathes of Iraq that aren't controlled by the occupation. It's still very anarchic here. And again, it's an extraordinary tribute to, lack of tribute to Bremer, that he's leaving at a moment when so much of Iraq just isn't under U.S. control.
joined on the telephone right now by Christian Parenti, independent reporter. Christian, last week was fired at by U.S. troops in Baquba. Can you talk about the resistance right now, Christian? Oh, I had hoped that Christian was with us. But Rahul Mahajan, let me put that question to you.
Well, I think that what has happened with the resistance in the last few days is a really a dramatic, important, and positive development. Last week, as you know, there was a single day of violence in which over 100 people were killed. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's al-Tawhid, al-Jihad, claimed responsibility for it. There's been a lot of grumbling from almost anyone about all of these attacks that seem to kill just huge numbers of Iraqis and not even necessarily targeted at U.S. forces. But on Saturday, across the country, anti-occupation figures, militant Sunni clerics, Muqtada al-Sadr's organization, and even a representative of Mujahideen in Fallujah all made open public statements denouncing these kinds of acts and distinguishing between terrorists committed by foreigners, much of which is directed at Iraqis, and what they call legitimate resistance. It marks the emergence of the resistance as a potential political force rather than one that can simply carry out stray hit-and-run attacks at the United States or perhaps engage in defensive actions like during the siege on Fallujah. If the resistance is going to build political weight and have a chance of challenging this attempt at U.S. hegemony, this is the path it's going to have to travel down.
At the same time that this is happening, a U.S. soldier died in Baghdad in a rocket attack just as the ceremony was taking place. Three Turkish men, one U.S. soldier, and one Pakistani man have been taken hostage by separate resistance groups who threaten to behead the men if demands are not met. The U.S. soldier being identified as Wasif Ali Hassoun, who is a Marine Corporal of Lebanese descent, I believe from Utah. Rahul Mahajan, can you talk about these hostages and the beheadings that we've seen over the weeks, the men always being put into orange jumpsuits like the prisoners held by the United States?
Well, these particular ones are uniquely bizarre because, of course, Turkey and Pakistan, neither one of them has troops in Iraq, and their involvement in the occupation is minimal, although, of course, among the civilian contractors augmenting the occupation forces, you find people from virtually every country, mercenaries for hire from all over the world. Acts, these kidnappings and threatened beheadings seem once again to be the work of groups like Zarqawi's, which is almost unique in Iraq in that it declares anyone that it doesn't like, and certainly any Iraqi working with the occupation in any capacity, including you know, washing laundry for the coalition forces, as not a Muslim, as an apostate. And since the Turks and the Pakistani and even the U.S. Marine are all Muslims, it seems once again to be something that has little to do with the indigenous Iraqi resistance, which is still very much focused on the U.S. military. Further speculations about what actually Zarqawi is and what kind of role he's playing. I mean, it's very clear that in a functional sense, he is propping up ideologically the U.S. occupation by trying to identify legitimate resistance with his kinds of acts, which really, to in Iraq, virtually nobody will support.
We do have Christian Parenti on the line right now from Baghdad. Christian, again, as I said, was shot at by U.S. troops when he was in Baquba last week. Christian, can you tell us where you are, your reaction to the early so-called handover and the situation of the resistance now in Iraq as you've been traveling the country?
Well, I'm in Baghdad now, and my reaction to the handover is pretty much the same one that most people on the street in Iraq have, which is that you know, a handover of documents done in a bunker, and it has really no meaning materially because there's still U.S. troops on the street. Reconstruction is still not happening, despite billions having been spent. And, you know, the services are down. The humiliation and violence of occupation continues, and no one here is really particularly excited either way about this. A lot of Iraqis have sort of fallen into a hopeful fatalism. They don't expect anything, but they kind of hope against what they really know is going to happen, that maybe this government will somehow get the U.S. out. In terms of the resistance, today has been very quiet. Yesterday there was some mortaring of the CPA, the Green Zone. Fallujah is the main flashpoint. Bakuba, the day that Dar and I were there, was a war zone, but now it is mellowed out, it's sealed off, and the resistance has done a couple operations, a couple hits on various buildings, but it's not open warfare there or any other place other than Fallujah. One of the key things that's gone on in this transfer is that Muqtada al-Sadr has declared a ceasefire. So the Mehdi army, the main element of the Shia militias that were fighting the U.S. in April, is keeping its powder dry. And that is in large part responsible for the peace on the streets. But, you know, who knows what will happen in the next couple of days. There will probably be some assassination attempts against members of the new government and car bombs. But right now, Baghdad is very peaceful, and people don't really think very much of this event. It's a non-event, really.
Christian Parenti, on with us from Baghdad, independent reporter, also speaking to Patrick Coburn with the independent newspaper in Britain. Rahul Mahajan on with us as well, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and writer of the blog Empire Notes. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Kansas City, working with KKFI Community Radio in Kansas City, Missouri, a battleground state. We're on the line with Baghdad, Christian Parenti, on the line with Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, on this day where a surprise secret ceremony took place two days earlier than the June 30th deadline for the so-called handover of power in Iraq. Christian Parenti, you've just been saying that there's not much belief that this really is a handover. You yourself were shot at by U.S. forces when you were in Bakuba. Place Bakuba for us and talk about what happened.
Bakuba is 35 miles northeast of Baghdad, and there had been fighting south of Bakuba for several days, and so another journalist who is familiar to listeners of this show, Dahar Jamal, and I went out there because we heard civilian casualties were coming into the hospital. We found the city to be sealed by U.S. forces, and we went in through a back way, and when proceeding in through a back way, we saw U.S. military vehicles, and we could see that they saw us, and then one of them shot at us three times. Our choice was basically to just rush in deep, and we found the city deserted and at war. There were Apache helicopters strafing the southern side of the city. No one was on the street. No shops were open. There were just a few cars around, which seemed sort of like Mujahideen patrols undercover, sort of looking for what was going on. And we interviewed a few people. We met a sheikh that we were there to find and stayed with him and heard the bombing. And then there was a lull in the fighting, and we decided that we would not make it to the hospital since that was closer to where things were being strafed and it was in Mujahideen positions. So we proceeded out of Bakuba, and on our way out, we saw a carload of civilians who had been shot up, with one corpse lying on the street, and at that point stopped our vehicle because we didn't want it. We also saw Humvees further on that had shot up this vehicle, and so then we had to walk out towards the Humvees, yelling that we were American soldiers not to shoot. And then we got there, the U.S. soldiers said that indeed this car was speeding towards them, and they actually claimed that it had rammed a tank, but it clearly had not rammed a tank because there was no sign of impact, and it was probably just speeding in their direction and might not have seen them, or the driver might have been scared, and they, as they say here, lit it up with a 50 caliber machine gun bullets and killed everyone inside. So we got out of Bakuba, and then I made contact with the sheikh we had visited, and he said he was kept in his house for the next 2 days by sporadic fighting, but that yesterday people were able to go out in Bakuba, and that the siege had lifted. And the whole thing jumped off really with the Mujahideen attacking the U.S., going on the offensive. And that day we expected this was sort of maybe the beginning of a wave of insurgent activity, but it seems to have tapered off for the moment, but anything could change. No one really knows what direction things will go here.
We're talking to Christian Parenti in Baghdad. We're also here in Kansas City, joined by Louis Duguid, who is an editorial writer for the Kansas City Star. He writes columns here, is on the editorial board, and is one of the few voices who've been opposed to the invasion from the beginning, spoke out very early at a time when not a lot of people here at this level, certainly in mainstream media, are doing this. We welcome you to Democracy Now! As well.
Thanks for having me as a guest.
Well, when we planned this discussion, Louis, this secret ceremony, we did not know about it, obviously. Now this has taken place, but you've been writing about Iraq for quite a while now. What is your response, and can you talk about the attitude of people here in Kansas City?
Well, I'm not surprised by what happened. This is a brilliant act of desperation. The administration obviously wanted to be able to say to the public that we handed over power just as we had promised. They did it ahead of time because it short-circuits any problems that might have occurred on June 30 or the lead up to June 30. This is an administration in the White House that has run everything secretly, from flying into Iraq in the dead of night to all of the politics that has come out of the White House. This just fits.
What kind of risks do you take to speak out here? I mean, it's hard to talk about risks when we're talking to reporters right now in Iraq. But in terms of how difficult is it to be critical at this point?
Well, I think that initially it was very difficult because few people were speaking out against the war. There were the committed folks who were part of the peace movement in the Kansas City area. But in terms of the mainstream media, the press largely had become part of the push to go to war. There had been some dissenting voices, but they weren't well liked or heard very much. It's there's been some risk, but at the same time, I think there's been a lot of support.
You are here in Missouri, here in the home state of John Ashcroft. As the war goes on abroad, there is a war right here at home. What insider perspective can you give us on the Attorney General who used to head up the state?
Well, of course, John Ashcroft was defeated in his bid for re-election to the Senate by a dead man, Mel Carnahan, who had been governor, well, like governor of Missouri, died unfortunately in a plane crash. Ashcroft rebounded and was put in the Bush administration over, well, as Attorney General. He's not well received in this state as someone who nationally is in a position that is taking away a lot of the freedoms of people in this country.
Right now, in Missouri, this is considered a battleground state. Why, and how does it compare to Kansas, Kansas City, in both states?
Right. Missouri can go either way, either Democrat or Republican. Missouri also, over the last many different presidential elections, has picked the winner. Missouri has that record, and I think that the electoral votes that Missouri can deliver to the candidate who is elected, and I hope it is an election this time, can be significant.
You've spoken out at rallies. You're an editorial writer. You're a columnist. Do you face any pressure from management of the Kansas City Star?
Well, I speak about 150 times a year in many different forums. I get asked to speak on issues that I write about regularly in columns, generally I've had the support of management. I think that the newspaper understands that people in the press, when asked to come and speak on issues related to war or peace, that the public is trying to hold the press to a new level of credibility and accountability. And so I simply go and I do these things, always couched in terms of what does it mean journalistically, what does it mean in terms of journalists doing a better job in covering the events that take place here in the United States. And we need to do a better job.
Louis Duguid is an editorial writer with the Kansas City Star. We're also joined on the line now from Ireland by Kieran O'Reilly. He's an Irish peace activist who was at Shannon Airport when President Bush arrived this weekend, a member of the Dublin Catholic community, awaiting trial for what he calls disarming a U.S. warplane in Shannon Airport in a separate plowshares action. Kieran, can you describe what happened this weekend when President Bush came to Ireland and then moved on to Turkey, where he's at the NATO summit?
For an 18-hour photo opportunity to garner Irish votes in the United States, I suspect. He landed at Shannon Airport, which is on the west coast, where 10,000 U.S. military pass through each month. There were about 1,400 people there to protest. There was 4,000 police deployed, 2,000 members of the Irish Army with armoured personnel carriers, and about 700 Secret Service travelling with the President. In Dublin, 30,000 people rallied against his arrival. On the Saturday, the Catholic Work and the Plowshares and 300 friends walked 5 miles from Clare Castle to stage Mac Bush, a play on Macbeth, and George in the Drumoulin Castle at the time. People were carrying cardboard cut-out trees with the name of an Iraqi child, the age they were killed by the U.S. military, and the means they were killed, cluster bombs, sniper fire, etc. We had a Banquo. I played Banquo, a dead U.S. soldier. Many have passed through Shannon, have returned in body bags. and we read the names of the U.S. military who have been killed in Iraq since this war began. Cueva Butterley from the Catholic Worker, who was shot in the leg in Palestine, taking children to school, played the role of Lady Macbeth, and she read the names of Iraqi children who died. And also we had a witch to cast a spell to drive George out of Poland. So it was relatively successful. He left, but before he left, he was delayed by about 40 minutes as a group of anarchists, nonviolent anarchists, blockaded the press corps arriving to the Bertie Ahern, George Bush love-in press conference at the airport. So the orientation of his visit was so media-orientated that they delayed the departure to Turkey. So quite a good weekend of nonviolent action against George.
Kieran O'Reilly speaking to us about his protests in Ireland. We are also joined in our Kansas City studio by Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn. As we talk about dissent, Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn was an Army captain, trained as a doctor, refused to serve during the Persian Gulf War more than 10 years ago. She ultimately was court-martialed, sentenced to 3 years in prison, served 8 months in the Brig at Fort Leavenworth. Is that right, Dr. Right. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn?
Yes.
In fact, interesting connections. Fort Leavenworth, the place where Lane McCotter worked. He headed the jail there in the 1980s, the man who later went on to head the Utah Department of Corrections, then worked in New Mexico as well, went to private Criminal Justice Corporation, where they ran the Santa Fe Detention Facility, which was then cited by the Ashcroft Justice Department for serious violations. So they took out the federal prisoners, and what happened then was Lane McCotter was one of those who was appointed by the Ashcroft Justice Department to set up the Abu Ghraib prison. Mm-hmm. Unusual connections. But your thoughts now on this day. You have certainly paid a price for your dissent at Fort Leavenworth.
My thoughts are that we basically, you know, as a physician, I take care of people, and I think we need to be concerned about the structures of society that either promote health or detract from that. And I'm appalled at what our government is doing with the resources of this country, and essentially denying care to people here, and then doing the kinds of things that are happening in Iraq at this time, using our resources to essentially not promote health in other parts of the world, to promote destruction and death. And I think that as citizens, we need to be more active, more proactive about changing that.
You paid a very serious price for your dissent. Did you expect the three-year sentence? You ended up serving 8 months. You were in the brig at Fort Leavenworth, right under death row.
The price was, I mean, compared to the price that the rest of the world pays for the foreign policy that the United States engages in, there's no comparison, to be honest. I think the focus should be on how our actions create essentially a price of death or a price of maiming or a price of even for our troops, people who are being used to promote a foreign policy that is not in the best interest of our country, and then who are left to suffer the consequences, like the folks that are being court-martialed. Now, no one is court-martialing or bringing the leaders of this country to the world court for the actions at the Abu Ghraib prison and in Guantanamo, and yet the United States military is court-martialing the privates, the folks who implement the policy. So I think that we need to look at what structures in this society create people who do things that are uncivilized, that are death promoting, and we need to hold them accountable. And
Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn, I want to thank you for being with us, wrapping up this program. Dr. Yolanda Hewitt-Vaughn, an Army captain who refused to serve during the Gulf War more than 10 years ago, saying she was trained to save lives, not take them. Well, that does it for today's program. I want to thank the UMKC Interactive Video Network with Bob Brodeur and staff here at UMKC in Kansas City. Thanks also to Friends of Community Radio Kansas City for fighting to preserve KKFI. We'll be continuing the Exception to the Rulers tour this week in Hempstead, New York at Bestseller Books tomorrow night, and Barnes & Noble June 30th at 82nd Street. Thursday night at Edmonton, Alberta. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, Mike Berkshire, Abdul Qudus. I'm Amy Goodman. Dennis Moynihan helped as well. Thanks for joining us.